Good evening, everybody. This is Jeff J. Brown, China Rising Radio, Sinoland, on the nighttime beaches of D-Day Normandy in France. And I've got my good friend and comrade on the show again, Ramin Mazahiri. How are you doing, Ramin?
Doing good. Great to be here, Jeff.
Hey, listen, I don't want to, we've already did the first half of his book, which I have read. I paid for it. I was happy to get it, and I got it, and I read it, and I loved it. And we've discussed the first half of the book, and tonight we're going to discuss the second half. I don't want to go into a lot of background, but I do want to ask, and so read the first half if you have not already seen it. Almost 20,000 people already have in the first month, and it'll go up even higher later as time goes on. So I do want to ask though, Ramin, and all the introduction and all that's in the first one. So let's get down to brass tacks. Don't want to go into a lot of detail and rehash the first half, but give us a 1 minute to 2 minute bullet, a summary of connecting the dots between the French Revolution in 1789. You know, Napoleon was a socialist, the Western liberal democratic coup of 1848, the counter coup of 1851, the communards and the neoliberal coup of 1871, which is now our European Union, and the yellow vest. Take it away, Ramin.
Well, you know, I am the journalist who has reported more, who's reported for more yellow vest demonstrations in English or French. There's nobody, you know, who's been there more often than me. So I sort of felt obligated to write a book about them to sort of end the Western propaganda on the yellow vests, because they are portrayed as this right-wing neo-fascist movement. But as my book shows, within the first month, even academics who had you know, jumped into studying them, they said, these guys are leftist-based. They're so I wanted to dispel, you know, the propaganda about them. And then I realized, well, we have to go back to, you know, to the age of austerity. And then I said, well, we have to go back really to, you know, the 1930s. And then, well, you know, what about the Paris Commune? You know, the people, there's so much propaganda about that. And there's so much propaganda about, you know, 1848. And then, well, what about Napoleon? How come they're so negative on this guy who upheld the ideals of the French Revolution? So this book, it kind of morphed into two parts. One part is an in-depth analysis of the yellow vests. And then the first part is going from the French Revolution all the way up into the 1930s. So basically, the first half is, you know, no yellow vest was alive. The second half is the yellow vest, how they came up, you know, with you know, the return of liberalism in the 70s. So it's kind of divided into those two. But what really holds it together, I think, what I think is really interesting, is that I was able, thanks to all of my reporting, I was able to put yellow vest quotes all throughout the book, actual yellow vest quotes. You have over 100 quotes from actual marching yellow vests going from the beginning until shortly before the book was published. And you just see how what the yellow vests are saying in 2018, 19, 20, 21, 22, what they're saying is so, and what they're demanding is so similar to the Paris Commune of 1871, the revolutions of 1848, you know, Napoleon, what he is upholding, you know, fighting against autocracy. And that's really sort of the last thing I'll say. It's the autocracy of monarchy. It's fighting against that. That's the start of modern political politics. That's modern politics saying we are moving away from kingship and moving towards the empowerment of the average person. And that's what the yellow vests are all about, because they are living under this pan-European project that has just not brought prosperity, stability, or security, even basic, you know, security for the rights of protesters under Macron. So let's not just blame Macron. Let's look at the roots of autocracy. Let's look at what the roots of modern politics is. And like you're saying, from 1789 until 1871, France was they were the leaders in you know, all of the West in terms of who was progressive politics. 1917 came along, the USSR, they took over. But you know, what we will see now is these yellow vests, they may not be the vanguard of the world, like, you know, like France was from 1789 until 1871. But nobody, there has been nothing like the yellow vest movement. You would have to go back to the 1930s to find a group that was so repressed and that took it, and they were so dedicated. So they really are worth examining for who they are, but then also how they link up with the world's great revolutions.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of security, it's I did not mark the page, but you have a page in here, and maybe you can remember as far as security of the protesters. You know, please cite from your book the stats on French authoritarian violence against the yellow vests. I mean, it's absolutely shocking. And based on that, who are more violent, French autocrats or American ones?
Let's start with the second one first. There's no comparison that it's so much more violent to be politically active in France than it is in the United States. In the United States, there's way more intimidation. There's just, you know, people from the mid-70s until George Floyd. There was maybe one day of nationwide political protest, and that was one day to try and stop the U.S. from going to war in Iraq. So we're talking about 50 years. France is a place where protesting is as necessary as a baguette. The idea that people would not be politically involved. Just when you go to a dinner party, you are expected to be able to talk seriously about politics and to take it seriously. Conversely, in the United States, if you go to a dinner party and you try and talk about politics seriously, people are going to get upset. It's a cultural illustration of how embedded political activism is in French culture. So French autocrats, French aristocrats, French neo-aristocrats, they know that that protests are coming, and that also the elite class in France is perfectly okay with looking the other way in terms of violence against protesters. We can make a comparison with the United States in that the U.S. elite is perfectly fine with violence and death that occurs in poor non-white communities. It's really something sort of, you know, very similar. So to answer your question about the actual numbers, the figures, you had 11 deaths. You had at least 11,000 arrests, at least 11,000. I think the actual number is really sort of much higher. You had at least 2,000 people getting prison sentences. So these are, you know, political prisoners. You had 1,000 serious injuries, like major, major injuries. And then you had scores of people being crippled or blinded. And I can just say from November, when it started in November 2018 until June 2019, you're talking about 6 months there or so, it was a bloodbath every Saturday. And who was getting hurt? You know, they have shown that, you know, almost half of the yellow vests had never participated in a political protest before. So this was not the rare segment of French society that was not politically active. But they were so outraged at how poorly France has done since 2009, and which is the year that the Lisbon Treaty was forced through and the Pan-European project really began. It has just gone terribly, terribly since then. And these people, who I refer to as the working poor class, because that's what they are. They are working, but they're not making enough money to have any sort of stability, much less any sort of good quality of life that their parents had, that their grandparents had. And they're not poor enough that they can qualify for social welfare measures. So they really are absolutely stuck. It really is absolutely very bleak. Mm-hmm. And then when you have the, not just Macron, you know, since 2009 across Europe, they have been rolling back the social safety net that millions upon millions upon millions of Europeans bled for in the wars of World War One and World War Two. So that sort of is sort of the background as to why they are so dedicated. The average yellow vester is in his or her early 40s, and there's a lot of women there too. And they just feel like if they don't stop this rollback that has been going, the age of austerity began, which was started by the great financial crisis of 2008. If they don't get out there, they have no reason to live. I mean, they are not having lives. They're just existing. And so this is, it's an escalation. I mean, when I first moved to France in 2009, by 2010, you had protests that were even more serious than the yellow vest. That was when Nicolas Sarkozy raised the retirement age, you know, by decree. And there was three 3 million person marches in 1 week, which the yellow vest never achieved. And there was violence. So, you know, there was tear gas. There was people getting hit with batons. There was water cannons. And so that was in 2010. It's not like this was brand new. And then every stage of austerity was the same thing, because they kept forcing through these right-wing economic measures to roll back the leftist-inspired social safety net, the socialist-inspired social safety mm-hmm. net. So what I'm trying to say is that the yellow vest, you know, you asked about who's more violent. It's France, and it's been this way every year. Every spring and every fall in France, since I've been here, there have been violent anti-austerity, anti-government protests, And some years have been worse than others. 2014, the yellow vest took it to something where they said, you know, kind of like the Five Star Movement, but even kind of more divorced from the political scene than that. You know, they came along and said, we reject everybody. You're right. It's us against the government, and everybody who's working with the government is basically a comprador. And they have certainly proven to be right, in my opinion, but you'll have to read the book and, you know, see what you think.
It's really impressive. Due to the totalitarian control of the big lie propaganda machine, the yellow vests are expunged from the media, as you know. And they are they still protesting as much as before, as widespread as before? I mean, tell us what's going on with the protests, because I get the impression there's a lot more going on than we're allowed to see.
You're absolutely right. So what happened, the evolution was, they started November 2018, and then May Day 2019, May 1st, by May Day, they had put in, so the government had passed so many anti-yellow vest laws that they scared the average person from going to the protests. That's really why it dwindled. There was just so much police violence, and they had zero, they said, you know, they made it open that if you come down there, not only will you be that, you're going to get arrested, but we are going to give you a prison sentence, normally of about 1 or 2 years. And this, you know, scared the average person away. So May Day 2019 was the bloodiest day I've ever seen in France, and I have seen some very, very rough days. And then this coincided with the end of Macron's great national debate, which you might remember, where for three months.
What a joke,
right? I mean, it was just, and the yellow vest knew it. This was a guy that didn't have his first press conference for 2 years. All of a sudden, every day, he's on TV getting more airtime than Fidel Castro. And it was a total about face, and the mainstream media just totally went along with it. And it was all one way. That was the problem. For example, he put immigration at the heart of his great national debate, even though immigration figured basically nowhere in the 42 key demands of the yellow vests. He was obviously using far right, you know, techniques, just installation of all these anti-LFS laws, 6 months of telling the average French person, do not come down in these protests. Stand up, calling them, casseurs, which means breakers or wreckers or really berserkers, portraying them as people without any sort of political thought in their head, and they just want to just break stuff. So my point is, then by June, by June 1st, it was clear that the handful of billionaires that own almost all of France's media, they colluded with the government to say, we are not covering the yellow vests anymore. So even though the yellow vests were going on, we stopped hearing about them. Even though there was still regular tear gas, regular violence, regular arrests. I'm talking about starting from June 2019, July, August, September, October, November, December, going into 2020. They never stopped. They were always there every Saturday nationwide, but they stopped being covered. There was a media blackout. That's the summation of what I'm trying to say. Is there was a media blackout until Corona hit, and then they were forbidden from marching, and then they started what they call season two, and that was October 2021, and they've been marching every Saturday since then, and the numbers are not what they used to be, but it's still 1,000 or 2,000 people every Saturday in Paris since October. So they're there. But if a tree falls in a forest, then no one hears it, doesn't make a sound. Yes, it does, because these serious activists are talking to people. They are coordinating. They are learning new strategies. They are creating this network that can be activated. These people have got lifelong bonds. These are more than friends. These are fellow comrades. I mean, we've all been, on our knees puking out our guts from, tear gas. They have had it even worse. I mean, I get it easy because I'm the press, but they're the ones who really get beaten. They're the ones who actually get arrested. They're the ones who actually, took huge fines. So, are the yellow vests still there? Absolutely. And they're still present around Europe. You see, when you watch some TV media coverage of Spain or of Italy, you will see of protests, you will see plenty of yellow vests. So it's something that situation starting in November 2018 until May Day 2019. This was a revolutionary situation, but the only revolutionaries were the yellow vests and the unions. They didn't have a general strike. It was not until 19. So it was a year after the yellow vests had been protesting that the unions finally said, oh, maybe we should join this, this wave of, social unrest. Maybe we could actually get something for somebody other than just our union members. But that's how the unions think. So in France and, across the West, I mean, this is just sort of West craft labor idea, as opposed to the leftist industrial union, big branch union kind of a thing. So they have been protesting. Just to sum up here for the viewer, they have been protesting. They had to take about a year and a half off because of Corona, just like everybody else. But they are there, and they're there right now. They will be there this Saturday. They are still there. They are still going. The question is, last thing, will things get so bad now? I mean, I just saw a poll, almost half the country wants to see a return of the yellow vests. Well, they've always been there. You just have to go join them. But, you might get beat up. You will definitely get tear gas. You might get arrested, Will things get back to that point? We will wait and see. Or will it happen in some other European country? Is France exhausted from 6 months of lockdowns every Saturday, bloodbath every Saturday? We'll have to see.
Yeah. Speaking of the unions and stuff, I was disgusted to see Jean-Luc Mélenchon. He's the leader of the left the political left, let's say, in France. And he announced a protest march next month in October to be bigger than the yellow vests, And the French left and the unions just ignore the yellow vests. And I even read that the French union, the CGT, marchers attack the yellow vests. What do you have to say about that? It's just awful that the yellow vests are even marginalized and ignored and despised by whom should be their natural allies.
What is it you were saying about the CGT, which is France's second largest union and sort of their most leftist one?
I read an article that they're in Paris at least one time. They physically attacked the yellow vests. I don't know if that's true or not.
Well, I mean, let's go back. The yellow vests absolutely refused to march with unions for the first 3-4 months. So there was a lot of hostility there. What I always said, and they refused. See, the thing is, the yellow vests, because the unions have signed off on every austerity measure since 2009. They are viewed as being a part of the system. They are viewed as being as bad as, for example, the mainstream media. They are viewed as being as bad as the Socialist Party of France, which is now totally gone. They're viewed as being as bad as mainstream politicians. And this is why the yellow vests were so popular, is that they admitted the truth. They said, we refuse to work with any of these people, because they're not on our side. So the unions, we have to get in the West, we have to embrace the yellow vest idea that we have to reject the mainstream unions, because for 40 years they have been on the wrong side. This is something that, for example, Trotskyists understand correctly, that craft unions, the CGT is the second largest union. The largest union, the CFP, this is a right-wing union. You know, just because you're in a union doesn't make you a serious leftist. And the yellow vests, they really, really understand that. So when it comes to the unions, they are viewed not just by the yellow vests, but by most of France, they're in it for themselves, which is kind of the essence of capitalism. This is the essence of liberal democracy. Oh, I have a lot of money. I can buy off a judge. I can buy time. I can buy advertising. Yeah, I'm in it for myself. So that's why there is this, you know, there were clashes between the unions and the yellow vests. And it's because the yellow vests refused to join any group. They wanted to create their own group. And this is linked to Jean-Luc Mélenchon. He is, you know, I think he's just the sort of the best France can do on the left. I am not as opposed to him as other French people are. I have lived in France since it's 2008. But other people, you know, I mean, you know, people who understand France better than me, they, you know, I have to, you know, tip my cap to them. They have told me for so long that he is just too divisive. He is unelectable. He's unwinnable. And then as time has gone on, especially the, yellow vest, they proved that he's a fake leftist who's a part of the system. You know, the Socialist Party of France, François Hollande, the ex-president, they've been totally masked as right-wingers. Well, Jean-Luc Mélenchon has really been unmasked as someone who's not really on the left. He's more leftist than most. He's sort of like a Bernie Sanders type of figure, you could say, for the U.S. But he is just sort of a safety valve. So he's not somebody. He is viewed, and he was a minister in a socialist presidency, socialist party presidency, and they certainly have. And then he broke with them because he said, you're moving too far to the right. But he's really somebody that has not been able to achieve what he said, and he's now 72, 73, and he said that the last presidential election, you know, just, you know, back in May, that was his last one. So for better or for worse, the French left is now totally without even a figurehead who can get 20-21% of the first round vote. I mean, back in 2017, he was 1 percentage point away from making it to the second round. So, but it's, you know, and then, you know, this time, you know, they had sort of like the blue wave in 2020 here in the U.S. You know, the French left united on paper for the first time in many, many decades, and they still fell short. And now the guy's too old. So, you know, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, he's viewed as a part of the system, and that's what he will go down as. And even though, you know, to the entire Western media, he's a firebrand leftist, but it's really not true. So, from the LFS point of view, they rejected Jean-Luc Mélenchon and his party, like they rejected the Socialist Party, like they rejected the unions, like they reject a lot of the top NGOs that waited 3 or 4 months to come out to condemn them. They are trying to create a whole new grassroots network, but at the same time, they're not getting involved in politics. You know, they refuse to have any sort of a leader. So, you know, people from Lenin onwards will tell you that, well, this is great, but this is doomed to failure because you don't, you know, because you're rejecting all bureaucracy. You're rejecting all leadership. And the Yellow Vests, you know, you can't say that they won. I think that Lenin, he would have predicted this.
Yeah. I'm glad in the book you brought up the controlled opposition like Black Bloc and Antifa. And when I was reading about it, it reminds me of the Cultural Revolution in China, the counter-revolutionary rightists who were against Mao, dressed up exactly like the real Red Guards for Mao Zedong, and the rightists were the ones who did all the damage to the temples and the cultural sites to destroy the reputation of the real Red Guards. I think this has been going on since the ancient Greeks, and you know, today we can call them false flags. But tell us what your impressions were when you saw Black Bloc and Antifa marching and tearing stuff up during the protests, and where you think they come from.
Just like you said, man, just like the people who are dressing up in burqas right now in Iran, and they're men and they are carrying guns because they are, you know, they are trying to destabilize Iran. That's the exact same thing. Like you said, it's probably been going on since the ancient Greeks. It's been going on since anybody, you know, wanted to actually push through some pro-democracy, pro-leftist economics reforms. Somebody, you know, it's been going on since anybody said, hey, King, we want to say too. We want to share the pie too. So it's been going on just that long. Certainly, Black Bloc and Antifa, they are, when it came to the Yellow Vest, it was just like, the Yellow Vest would just say all the time, they're just like pulling out their hair and saying, why? Because a lot of them had, you know, like I said earlier, half of them had never been in a protest. They're pulling out their hair and they're saying, why don't the cops stop these people? Get this Black Bloc out of here. They're ruining everything. And this is something that, you know, I could give you countless, you know, I have been to, it must be 1,000 demonstrations over the past, you know, 100, it's close to it, since, you know, 2009. And you just see Black Bloc and Antifa do these things that are so out of left field, that are so going to just discredit the movement, that you finally accept that, oh yeah, those are cops in, you know, those are reactionary forces, you know, dressed up all in black, because what you're doing has nothing to do with any sort of leftist ideology. So I can give you examples from, you know, so many just off the top of my head. But when it came to the Yellow Vests are, you know, saying zero tolerance for Antifa, zero tolerance for Black Bloc. But the problem is that the Yellow Vests, these are, you know, middle-aged people who are patriotically and humanistically protesting. They're not there to start a fight. They're not there to, you know, bring weapons. Antifa is. Black Bloc is. You know, whatever the element of actual leftist sincerity is there, there's still this element of they have been co-opted. You know, there are people dressing up. There are infiltrators, but Antifa and Black Bloc, this is what they used. So, you know, it's just kind of interesting, maybe, I think, for your viewers. You know, outside of France, the Yellow Vests were slandered as being far-righters. The Brexiteers, the Leavers, you know, of France, But that didn't work in France because, you know, within the, you know, French mainstream media, that wouldn't work at all because people realized that they were not right wingers. To, you know, their, to insult them was that they were casseurs. And, you know, casseur means to break. So they are, they were breakers. They were wreckers. They were berserkers. They were Antifa. They were Black Bloc. And it couldn't have been, you know, couldn't have been more obvious, you know, the, you know, difference between someone coming up all in black, totally covered up. You don't know who they're, who they are. And someone coming in a high visibility, being real Shaheed, being real martyrs, standing up and, you know, and, you know, did, were there some yellow vests who fought back? You see your buddy get cracked in the head by a baton. You're not happy about it. You get cracked in the head, you're going to, you know, your self-preservation is going to kick in. But Black Bloc and Antifa, they were exactly like the cops in that they were initiating violence, not the yellow vests, not the yellow vests, you know.
I was shocked to learn about the secret Euro group. Please tell us about it and where it fits in with the European Union, the European Commission, and the European Parliament. I think most people out there think it's all just one big entity, but this Euro group is obviously quite nefarious.
It absolutely is. It absolutely is. And it's complicated when you're talking about the Pan-European project because there are multiple organizations and, you know, they overlap and they don't overlap. It's you know, purposely confusing. You have, you know, who's in the Euro? Who's in the European Union? You know, the average person, it's kind of tough for them to, you know, keep tabs on all this. But the, what people cannot keep tabs on, because there's basically a media blackout on them, it's the Eurogroup. And this is a informal, unaccountable group basically of the countries in the Euro. And this is the group that has the most power in Europe, more than the European Commission, more than anybody in Strasbourg or Brussels, because they control the Euro. They control what is, I guess it's got to be now the third largest macroeconomic bloc. You have the U.S. and then China since 2008 has really surpassed the Euro, and now you have the Euro, which has gone from being, you know, worth $1.60 American down to 97 cents American. But the Eurogroup is something that they are the monthly meeting, and they are the ones who are deciding what the budget is in Italy. They are the ones deciding on what sort of financial measures are going to be taken in Spain. This is the most important group because they have the economic purse strings, and yet nobody talks about it. We have to tip our cap to the Greek finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis. He was the first one. He was a real whistleblower because he was the Greek finance minister. And he was the one that showed how this group really works and how it's a cabal of central bankers working with private bankers to absolutely control social policy across the Eurozone. So he's the one that, you know, really showed just all these shocking things. I mean, for the mistakes that they make, but there's not even any minutes of their meetings. So, you know, one thing that I can say is that in writing this book, it was just going to be about, and, you know, dispel the myths of so many different great revolutionary eras that are similar. But one thing that surprised me is how, looking over from 2009, all of the reports that I did as a, you know, on the street reporter, and I think that has, being an on the street reporter, daily hard news, you have a different point of view. There's, and it's got virtues and it's got flaws. You know, you have the analyst point of view, you have the, I don't know, NGO person point of view, you have the actual politician's point of view, like Yanis Varoufakis. That was, his point of view was phenomenal. Thank God he shared it. But I think the hard news daily journalist, we have to make decisions and we have to make judgments every day. How is this policy working? How does this compare with, you know, You know, every day is like we are adding up evidence. We are building up evidence. You know, daily journalism is just the history of yesterday. So what I'm trying to say is that I was very surprised when I started to write this book, and I went over all of my reports from 2009, and I did probably 15 a month for 10 years. You know, I might have been the most active TV journalist, TV reporter in all of France. I'm not trying to brag, but that's a lot of reports. Journalists will tell you that. So I was surprised at how negative I had to be about the Pan-European project in general, because it's just a history of failure until 2022. And I am not against a united Europe, but I don't see how anybody looking at the social, economic, and security catastrophe. Now we have Nord Stream, you know, 1 and 2. The security catastrophe represented by the yellow vests. I don't know how anybody can be in favor. Is the most flagrant example of how this is really what I call a bankocracy, that bankers are absolutely running the show. And this is something that Karl Marx pointed out in 1848. He saw that, you know, once we moved away from absolute monarchy with 1789, and you saw the Industrial Revolution, take root, and you saw the financial banking revolution that followed along with it, he saw that by 1848, which is the first time that liberal democracy was really implemented, he saw that this is just financial capitalism that is in charge. This is just the wealthy. It's the former aristocrats and kings and princes joined with the nouveau riche, this really elite banker industrial class. That's sort of the most important thing, is that when you read Marx on France from 1848, it's the exact same complaints of the yellow vests in 2019. So this Euro group, it's something that is, you know, protected by, you know, the EU. It has been given formal recognition by the EU, constitutions, you know, things like that. That's what I'm trying to say, the EU legal framework. But there's no accountability. There's no minutes. There's no way to influence policy, you know, to influence them. It's just the finance ministers. And that's why it's really interesting, for example, you know, when they were talking with von der Leyen, you know, the head of the EU about Italy right now, are you worried that... what's the name, you know, Meloni, and I forget the name of her.
Giorgina Meloni.
Right. And her group, I can't think of the name of the group, they asked, are you worried about that? And she said, no. She said, we will look at what they actually offer. And then she said, we will look at who is the finance. She said, so the minister is so important because they're going to play a role in the Euro group. They're not going to play a role, but they want somebody submissive. As long as they're a puppet that's going to play ball, you know, with the Euro group, that's all they really care about, because then they control the Euro, then they control budgets, then they control finances. So the Euro group, you have to learn about them, but you're not going to find anything in the mainstream media, even though it's the most important group in the Pan-European project. But last thing I'll say is, I just, you know, it was a surprise to me that, you know, when you add up 2009 until 2022, the Pan-European project has absolutely failed.
I agree. I live here. It's a disaster. It's an absolute disaster.
It is. And what's going to happen this winter for you guys? I mean, they have cut off all the Russian oil coming to Europe now.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, you were telling me a while back your heating bill was up 250%, and it wasn't even winter.
Yeah, I know. It's frightening. Everybody just seems to be going along with it. Germans are ready to go without toilet paper, and they're ready to have heating tents outside in their neighborhoods to stay warm. And everybody's being told to be prepared to starve to death. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but that's not far from the truth.
It's not far. Yeah. Oh yeah.
And we may not have enough, you know, gasoline. We may not have enough diesel fuel. We may not have enough electricity. The only good thing in France is we've got 75 nuclear power plants.
Only half of them are working, though.
Yeah, they're supposed to have them all online by February. A big slug of them are coming on. Not half, but about a third of them were not working. But they're now going in, and they renationalized Electricité de France, the big electrical company, so that they have total control of the company. So we're a little, you know, and all the power plants were supposed to be back online by February or March. But, you know, just I keep seeing these like little things, you know, like from Twitter and stuff, where a restaurant owner in Brittany got an electric bill for something like, you know, 12 or 15,000 euros, and in 2019 it was like 1/10 of that. So
yeah. What's coming? How long can this last?
Well, yeah. I think it's you know, I think it's all part of the World Economic Forum, you know, cabal to destroy the middle class, destroy the entrepreneur class. As you know, everybody thinks America's full of entrepreneurs. Europe has got millions and millions and millions of entrepreneurs. One person, two person, mom and pop stores and shops and plumbers and carpenters and it just goes on and on and on. Well, you know, little bakeries and vegetable shops, you know that, and millions of those have already been, you know, taken out of business across Europe. And I think, you know, this is the second attempt to destroy what's left of the middle class and the entrepreneurial class in Europe. And of course, what's going to happen is then the Eurogroup type people, the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers and the Carnegies and the Vanderbilts and the Schiffs and the House of Windsor and the City of London will come in and buy all this stuff up for 10 cents on the euro, and then all those entrepreneurs can rent what they used to own, pay twice as much, and work twice as hard and make half as much money. So
right. I mean, what are we talking about? I mean, we are talking about how they want to return to the feudal era.
Exactly. Feudalism.
1788.
Yeah.
That's what they want. And they want, and this is why the LMS are so important, is that they want everybody to be dependent. They want everybody to be in the working poor class, where you're working, but you're still poor. That's why the LMS are at the vanguard of what's going on in the West, in Europe right now, is that they have endured this the most, and they showed so much resolve and so much desperation. You know, which is composed of monarchists, ex-monarchists, aristocrats, bankers, industrialists, hedge fund managers, you know, high finance. They want to reduce everybody back to 1788, where they are dependent like serfs, and where they are working all the time, but they will never get ahead. They will always be in debt. They will be debt slaves. And this is what the Yellow Vests, they are those people already. They've lived it, and they're trying to get people to say, look at the sacrifices I can make. If you do it too, we can really take back our country, and we can take back the whole world.
Yeah. Well, listen, this has been wonderful, Ramin. Before we sign out, I didn't ask you in the first half, what are your current writing and journalism plans, projects?
I appreciate it. You know, the Yellow Vest book was a real baby. It was 9 months of start to finish with a ton of research. And it also came amid the French election. So I don't have any plans right now. I have to sort of just lay low. I've actually been sent to the United States to cover their midterms. That's where I am right now. I don't care. If aliens came down and won the United States midterms, I don't think I'd care. Because it just, to talk about a society where the politics doesn't make any sort of difference. So I'm just kind of laying low for a bit. I don't have any big plans. I feel like I've been I've done 3 books in 5 years, and then, you know, I just got to take a break. I mean, we'll see, and then we got to see kind of what, you know, how things, what's going to happen. I don't know. If something really great comes along, I will certainly do it. But you know, I am primarily a reporter. You know, so I'm going to keep reporting, and I just got to gather, you know,
for Press TV.
That's right. I've been with them, you know, almost exclusively for 12 years. So I'm just going to keep talking to people on the street, which is my job, getting their opinion. They're often so much smarter than me. I'm going to keep my ear to the ground, and we'll see. But hopefully I'll come up with something. But I don't really have anything. Just follow me on Press TV. I'll be doing, you know, some writings. I'll be covering the U.S. midterm. And we'll see after that. And then I'm going to be covering, you know, I'll be going to Cuba in spring, covering their elections. So I'm going to be moving around a bit more. But if you have any, you know, if anyone has any ideas, let me know. But I do need a bit of a break, I'll be honest with you.
Well, listen, Ramin, this has been wonderful. And it'll be a nice bookend to our first interview about discussion about your wonderful book again, Francis Yellow Vest. Thank you. Western Repression of the West Best Values. It's also available in French for any of the Francophones out there on Amazon. So buy it. It's really, really worth reading. I learned so much.
Thank you.
And since then, I've read Ramin's book about Iran's Islamic socialism. And that's going to be our next discussion, because I also you have educated me much, my dear friend.
Jeff, you have for me. I don't know about that, but you have. And, you know, there's, you know, as me and you were just talking about, thanks to you, I was able to make a great comparison of the Basij with the Chinese Communist Party. And I'm talking about their structures and their methods. So, your stuff is great.
Really good book.
Love your stuff.
Listen, my friend, I will give you a Buddhist bow. I will give you a Buddhist bow. And,
thank you very much. Iranian, I guess, the Muslim. Hand over the heart. Thank you very much.
Yeah, put your hand on the heart, yeah, like they do in North Africa. Anyway, thanks a million. I'll get this up, and hopefully you can share it when I get it produced. All right?
Thank you so much, Jeff. Always great to talk with you. Keep up the great work.
Thank you.
All right, buddy.